Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to A Voyage to Antarctica. I'm Alok Jha. This week, we're doing something a little different. I'm speaking to three unique contemporary artists. Peter Liversidge, Lucy Orta, and Mark Rees, all of whom have been invited to make a new work inspired by Antarctica for the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust's Antarctica in Sight programme. I want to know how Antarctica has influenced their work and understand why the icy continent has been a particularly inspiring place for so many artists, even before the first sighting 200 years ago.
My name is Lucy Orta, and I'm a visual artist, but I work together with Jorge, who's my husband and partner, since the early 1990s. And together we've been tackling, I guess, all kinds of key social and ecological challenges through our practice as artists. And we've created all kinds of artworks that explore issues, themes, for example, water scarcity, climate change, and loss of biodiversity.
My name is Mark Rees, and I live in Cardiff, and I'm an interdisciplinary artist, and I mainly focus on site-located community responsive work, so sort of immersive theatre, really.
My name's Peter Liversidge, and I start all projects with proposals, so I write descriptions of work in relation to each and every project, so every project is unique.
Can you give me a couple of examples? So for this particular project, Antarctica in mind, what kinds of things have you come up with?
One of them was that I proposed to build from snow and ice a group of Easter Island type heads on the island of Port Lockroy. The heads would be slightly closer to effigies and would all face north. This is, again, a description for work which would be actually, well, I'll describe it to you. I propose to add a spoken word piece to all the sat-navs currently in use around the world. The text will be spoken in the same voice of all other instructions that are given by the sat-nav. The text will read, "Currently the poles are melting." The text will be delivered to the driver at the start and the end of each and every journey. And so in that way, that work just exists as a an abstract sense or idea.
Tell me about your work for the Antarctica in Sight programme. What kinds of artwork are you developing there?
So for me, it's like, without giving it away, because it is very much about whale song, and it's a kind of sonic SOS to draw attention to their plight and the plight of the planet. And I have a very good friend of mine who's the writer Philip Hoare. I don't know if you know him. He wrote the book Leviathan and The Sea Inside and Rising Tide, Falling Star, fantastic books. I mean, he is so knowledgeable about kind of marine life, I mean, Wales especially. And I also I met his friend Chris Watson, who is an ex-Cabaret Voltaire member and is David Attenborough's main sound man. So I knew that I could access kind of, you know, authentic sounds of whale song recorded in Antarctica. So I'm working with him. I've commissioned a text from Philip about kind of whale song and about Antarctica that then Keris Matthews will read, and that will appear by magic in different places. It's the kind of like sonic takeover or multi-city podcast, excuse the pun. And for me, it was really important. I mean, obviously the whales are really important, and I've learned so much from Philip. I mean, because, you know, in the 20th century, we killed 3 million great whales. And, you know, majority of that was in the Southern Ocean of the Antarctica. And what's really interesting is, you know, the sheer removal of that biomass, you know, from then, the still unpolluted, unplasticized oceans probably accelerated climate, you know, the climate breakdown. And if you think of, you know, movement, political, you know, climate movements, Save the Whale was massive in the 70s. And in a way, it is a precursor. It's the direct ancestor of Extinction Rebellion. So it's so interesting as the whales are so symbolic to that plight, and especially their song is so heartfelt, and everybody knows that sound no matter what. So I think if you play that, if you hear that somewhere incongruous, if you're walking down a street and you know what it's about.
Yeah, we've been invited by the Antarctic Heritage Trust to create a new edition of the Antarctica World Passport and to distribute this throughout the UK during the Antarctic bicentennial. And in order to do that, we want to create a format that will allow the general public to learn more about the issues relating to Antarctica, and very important ones like the sea level rise and the danger of climate change affecting the Antarctic continent, and also linked to our project, the wider themes of migration. Of course, we know that many more people in the future are likely to be displaced because of environmental disasters than they are because of conflict. So these two issues side by side are something that we wish to kind of draw attention to through the Antarctic Passport Project. So the installation will be a passport office that we'll make using reclaimed materials, very similar to the kinds of passport offices that we've taken all the way around the world to date. And from this passport office, we'll be able to distribute these passports. We're hoping to print another 15,000 copies. So we'll be almost up to 100,000 copies of passports, and use that as a forum for discussion. So a place that people can come to. And I think post-confinement, post-lockdown, post-COVID pandemic, all kinds of issues of identity, nationality, of movement across borders will be even more important to discuss in the future. So it can provide, we hope that this artwork can provide a discursive platform in a way, in a different format, of course, because it's art. And there's a kind of neutrality behind art, that we know we're not promoting any political party, we're not promoting any political ideals, but this, in a sense, this neutrality can help bring people together, we hope.
Because it was the 200th anniversary of the discovery of Antarctica as a continent, we were looking to work with 200 primary schools and primary school children. We provide them with watercolours and watercolour paper. And the watercolours would be, and Winsor and Newton, who actually supplied the original watercolours on Scott's expedition, as sets of watercolours that were based on the potential colourways of icebergs. And as you know, watercolour paint needs to be activated by water. So very luckily, the British Antarctic Survey collected icebergs for me, which are now in quarantine in Cambridge. And that water will be given to these 200 schools and the 60 children per school, they will be given meltwater from icebergs to activate the watercolours. And what we would ask them to do is make paintings using that iceberg water and the watercolours to make paintings of what they imagine icebergs look like.
So tell me about Antarctica. What is it about Antarctica that's particularly inspired you?
I think for me, Antarctica, when they first approached me to commission me, and I was like, oh, wow, you know, of course, I have thought about Antarctica, especially of late, as it's, you know, such a key kind of important thing to consider as it is melting. And of course, it is so prescient in terms of what's happening, you know, globally with the climate change. So it's all in our minds. And in a way, it's come back into focus because I was thinking about this, because during lockdown, everything has become kind of micro and close up and kind of claustrophobic. And kind of that thought of this kind of white vastness of this kind of like huge plane and sort of like was sort of inspired me in a way. So I kept on kind of thinking it as a place kind of reflection into with that kind of emptiness in a way. Because as a contrast to where I'm at now, which is so close and so intimate. So it's kind of inspiring, really, in a sense of that kind of vastness and in terms of able to kind of let your ideas kind of go. I mean, I've never been there. This is all in my head, right? Kind of, you know, imagine in my imagination, but hopefully one day I will go there. So it was really interesting to create a contemporary response to mark the 200th anniversary and how I could create something which would draw attention to it and to the, of course, you know, to the plight of the planet, because I don't think currently, you know, as a contemporary artist, like you have to address that, because otherwise, you know, it's our responsibility. We have a responsibility, you know, for the future of the younger generation, etc. So that's why this was a real opportunity to do that as well.
Well, Jorge was invited to represent Argentina in 1995 at the International Art Biennale in Venice, the Venice Biennale, as it was called then. And he wanted to explore a very long-term project using the Antarctic Treaty as the starting point to reflect on a community that would come together under the ambitions of the Antarctic Treaty, I would say. So for us, this treaty was a really important symbol, something that we could work towards in terms of creating a new community, maybe a utopia that would become real. And well, we thought that the continent, you know, as it was so extreme, it imposes this mutual aid and solidarity and freedom of research and sharing and collaboration for the good of the planet. So all of these ideals were really, really important for us at that time. But it wasn't actually until 2007 that we had the opportunity as a team at Studio Orta to be invited to go to Antarctica. And it was the occasion of the End of the World Biennial, which was taking place in Ushuaia, which is one of the air bases that is closest to the Antarctic continent. So we used this opportunity to actually travel there. The team traveled there and we staged an ephemeral, if you like, performance or installation in Antarctic. And the performance took the form of an installation of a village, a tent village. We call them dome dwellings. So around 50 dome dwellings were installed across the continent with the help of the scientists at the Morambio Antarctic base.
Why do you think art has an important role to play in telling the story of Antarctica?
It can point out things that aren't, you know, that are possibly. It points out the sort of subtleties as well as the obvious and the less straightforward things. You know, the things that you could see if you read, any historic document or looked at the watercolours or thought of Antarctica in the abstract. It can just point out, perhaps it can, you know, if Antarctica had corners, it could point out the corners. It could point out those things that are not necessarily immediately obvious, or perhaps the more obvious things, like the poles are melting. in a way that just gets you to think about it. And it's not about necessarily immediately changing someone's opinion or mind or perspective of a place, but it's just making them think about it in a way that it might be a slight deviation. You know, it's like taking a B road instead of the motorway. You know, you just have this trip that takes you somewhere. You still get to the same place and perhaps your mind isn't changed, but equally on that deviation, you might get a totally different view or vista along, you know, what you were thinking about, or maybe not.
We certainly believe and have even been able to test this, that art can help raise awareness. It can help translate complex scientific information into formats that can reach audiences in the ways that data and statistics can't. And we've seen that different art formats have a capacity to trigger emotional responses, to touch people in different ways. We've tested this through the experience of seeing, of listening to, touching, and participating in something. So feeling part of something, feeling enveloped, embodied by an artistic form. So certainly, yes, art has a role to play.
I think, well, I mean, in my work itself, I often kind of shed new light on history, on pieces of history, on a building. You know, I often describe myself as an archaeologist exhuming a multi-layered history of a site and then unearthing kind of fragments of either, you know, fossils of fact or fiction. And then I pass them on to artists or members of the community to deduce and reinterpret and reimagine. And then I that rediscovered material is then molded into a composite portrait of a place. So for an audience to encounter as an immersive experience. So I think, you know, so it's looking at that history, that heritage in a different way and presenting it in new forms. So I think this is an opportunity. People might think, oh, heritage, boring, or they know the history of Antarctica, but there's so much. I mean, I went up to Dundee for the first time and went to the, you know, on board the Discovery. It is the Discovery, isn't it? Yeah, so Captain Scott's ship. And it was extraordinary, but also just to learn how reliant Dundee was on the whaling industry and that connection, and it made the city. And it was extraordinary. They didn't realise that so many whales had been killed, but that was an integral part of their survival, and that was their income, and, you know, etc. So it was sort of, that was profound, really. So therefore, it's an opportunity to shed light on history differently, to present in a different way. And I think that's exciting, because often people think, you know, history is boring or heritage is dull, but it's super exciting to reimagine it or present it in a different way.
Can I ask you, are whales something that you've been interested in throughout your life? Is there sort of a boyhood fascination with whales?
I think, well, I've always was fascinated during the 70s. I mean, I was born in the 60s, so I can, you know, remember Save the Whales and being, you know, thinking, God, this is really important, that, you know, it should be involved in, and was fascinated by it. And of course, by, you know, watching the documentaries, you know, and David, you know, with David Attenborough. So it's something that wasn't actually at the forefront of my mind, but it was always there, knowing that it was really important. But it's since meeting Philip, really, and he's so eloquent and articulate and passionate about those mammals that it's infectious. This was an opportunity to create, you know, a contemporary response that hopefully would resonate with other people by using something very basic and primal as kind of whale song, and working with Philip, who is an, you know, absolute kind of expert. And he did write, I mean, I spoke to him yesterday, and he did write something. And I could read that out, if you like. He's written something, you know, for us, for this kind of podcast. Do you mind if I read it?
Please do.
Their fate resounds in their song. The glorious thing about being a whale is that they live in a sensorial world of sound. They feel vibrations with their gigantic bodies. Lacking hands and fingers and living and feeding in sometimes pitch black conditions, sight is of little use to them. Sound is tactile to them, a physical internet of expression that they perceive using their sonar. Sensing one another around each other, they feel communally, orally connected. It's their ESP, their water telepathy. It is their culture.
Just one final question, which we've asked of all our interviewees. Why does Antarctica matter to you?
I think Antarctica matters to me because it's always, it's something, I think those sort of seared images from when I was, you know, 10, 11 at primary school, maybe slightly younger, and that sort of heroic sense of, it felt like a, it felt more of a frontier to me than the moon. It felt more abstract and more non-existent because obviously, you know, I could be in my back garden in Lincolnshire when I was growing up in the middle of nowhere and I'd look up into the sky and I'd see the moon. But I could only see Antarctica through books or through descriptions in books. And, you know, any photograph is still just a 2D rendering of a physical environment or a thing. And it's only the way that that thing or physical environment reflects light. So in that way, it's that sort of the imagining space that you get with something that is so unknown.
I think Antarctica matters to me because it is the lifeblood of the planet. I think just to go back to what, you know, David Attenborough was saying, that, you know, we need to, you know, we need to protect it, we need to preserve it, we need to look after it. You know, the balance, you know, in order to restore that equilibrium within the planet. So, I mean, that's why it is so important. And, you know, and because it's the main habitat of the whales, and discover how whales are so important to the whole ecology, if learning that from Philip, I think that, you know, that's why it's so important. And that's why I agreed to do this commission to make something that, you know, spoke to people and drew people's attention to it, given that we are marking this occasion of the 200th anniversary of the discovery of Antarctica. You know, what have we done in the last 200 years? What have we done? What can we do to change that mindset or that disconnection? How can we reconnect with the natural world? It's is vital for our future and the future of the younger generation.
It matters because this, the Antarctic continent in our imaginary, and I think in the imaginary of many people, is this immaculate whiteness, this immaculate continent of ice sheets. And in a sense, this whiteness, this immaculate ideal contains all the wishes of humanity. And it matters so much for us because it can help spread this message of hope for future generations.
A Voyage to Antarctica was presented by me, Alok Jha. It was produced by Jessica Norman, with Ben Hewis as digital producer. Music was composed by Alec Hughes. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. A Voyage to Antarctica is part of the UK Antarctic Heritage Trust's Antarctica in Sight programme, celebrating and reflecting on the past 200 years of human endeavour across this fascinating continent. The UK Antarctic Heritage Trust is the charity championing the public understanding of and engagement with Antarctica. You can find out more at www.ukaht.org. Next time, I'll be talking to Professor Klaus Dodds about Antarctica's potentially precarious future and what we can all do to protect it. See you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ,
the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.